From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Russia's sudden intervention last September in Syria's brutal civil war was a shocker, and it turns out a game changer. Vladimir Putin said he'd come to fight terrorism. The net effect of a lot of Russian bombing was to turn the tide of war in favor of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Now Putin is delivering another surprise. The main part of Russian forces are pulling out, he said yesterday. And today, they're in the air, apparently, headed home. This hour on Point, Putin's new move out of Syria and what it means. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you envious? 6 months in, out, done. Where does this leave Syria? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. There was no public signal in advance on this. Yesterday, meeting at the Kremlin in Moscow, Vladimir Putin announced a pullout of what he called the main part of Russian forces from Syria, interpreted here by CNN.
I believe the goal set out to the Ministry of Defense and the armed forces has in large part been fulfilled. That is why I ordered the Minister of Defense to start the pullout of the main part of our military grouping from Syria.
We're going to look from a number of angles at this surprise Russian move today as peace talks pick up in Geneva and we have a cessation of fighting, partial at least, in Syria. Joining me first from New York is Clarissa Ward, senior international correspondent for CNN, just back from Syria, where she's been reporting behind rebel-held turf for her series Undercover in Syria. Clarissa Ward, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
You've just been in Syria. You've seen the impact of this six and a half months of Russian bombing on the ground. How profound has the Russian intervention been?
It has been extremely profound. In fact, it's hard to overstate just how profound. I was in Aleppo 4 years ago, and I thought to myself that it couldn't possibly get any worse. During that time, there was relentless bombardment from the regime, from the air force of Bashar al-Assad, but largely they were using these sort of improvised, homemade explosive barrel bombs that were being dumped out of the back of helicopters. The Russians, obviously, when their intervention began, they're using far more sophisticated weaponry, and the scope and the scale and the intensity of the bombardment has really upticked dramatically as a result of that. You know, we were on the ground for less than 24 hours before we saw our first airstrike, filming in a small town called Ariha in Idlib province. We heard the sort of sickening sound of fighter jets wheeling overhead. Moments later, their payloads hit a fruit market, a small fruit market filled with people, and the scenes that we saw on the ground following that and that our team were able to capture were just sickening, Tom. I mean, really, really sickening. We saw a woman killed, a young boy rushed to hospital who later died of his injuries. To people on the ground inside rebel-held Syria, it really feels as though everyday life has been the target of this regime Russian bombardment. You know, Russia has said many times that it is targeting terrorists, but to people on the ground, they told us over and over again, this is a war against everyday life. This is the tax, one man told me, of living in liberated areas.
I've got a little of that, but first, here's the sound of Russian planes. This is shortly after the surprise intervention by Moscow. Russian planes dropping bombs east of Damascus in October, last fall. And here from CNN's new Undercover in Syria series by Clarissa Ward, the man in Aleppo talking about that tax.
The Russian planes target anything that works in the interest of the people. The goal is that people here live a destroyed life, that people never see any good, that they never taste life. This is the tax of living in a liberated area.
Clarissa, what about the tide of this war and how it changed the dynamic in this quick six and a half months? It appeared that Assad was in trouble when Russia showed up. I don't know how deep that trouble was. And the word we get more lately is that he's back in pretty good shape. Is that true?
Absolutely. There was a definite shift. I mean, this time a year ago, you had a grouping of Islamist factions who joined together to fight under the banner of Jaish al-Fatah, or the Army of the Victorious. They were enjoying some pretty serious victories on the battlefield in Jisr al-Shahur, in Idlib City, and other places. And then the Russian involvement really scaled those victories back and, in fact, gave the momentum, unsurprisingly perhaps, to the Assad regime. And I think the place you saw that most pronounced is in the city of Aleppo, which the eastern part of it had been under rebel control, but under Russian air cover, and we're talking virtual carpet bombing in the eastern part of the city, Assad's troops were able to essentially encircle that rebel-held eastern part of the city, and there's now only one road going in and out that the rebels and people who support the rebels are able to use, leaving more than 300,000 people potentially under siege. So there's no question that the Russian intervention had a major, profound impact on the ground in favor of the regime of Bashar al-Assad and his army. Now, the question is, with the Russians now saying that they're going to pull out, will that balance be altered?
Of course, we've got these peace talks just gearing up in Geneva. That turning of the tide in favor of Assad has put the government in a position where it says they have no preconditions on these talks. And we heard that just yesterday. This is Bashar al-Jafri, heads the Syrian government delegation. He accused the opposition of setting preconditions, said, no way, Euronews interpreting here.
Our dialogue is based on the fact there are no preconditions. We're already negotiating with many opposition groups which are fragmented and don't have a unified program. Preconditions signify a blockage of dialogue and the desire for this new round of talks to fail, like the last time.
Clarissa, I want to look at where those talks could go, but I want to stay on the ground for a moment here, because do you have the sense that for all the talk of tide turning, does that mean to you, from what you've just so recently seen, that Assad's forces could actually retake control of at least the part of Syria that is not dominated by ISIS? Or is it still a quilt, a patchwork of division sort of sliced and diced and ungovernable?
I think it's very much still a patchwork, exactly as you just described. And if the Russians are withdrawing their support, albeit temporarily, from the regime of Bashar al-Assad, I think it will be difficult for them to maintain this momentum. I would like to also emphasize that even if they were to take some of these rebel-held areas, they will be fighting an insurgency that will never, ever end, because what was so clear from all the conversations I had with people on the ground is that the issue of living under Bashar al-Assad again is a complete non-starter for the Syrian people living in these rebel-held areas. And I even attended a protest against the ceasefire, which is not because the people don't want peace. It's because they have no faith in the negotiations that are going on in Geneva. They see this essentially as a sort of chess game being played out between superpowers in which they are the unwitting pawns. And as long as those peace talks are continuing without the absolute demand that President Assad step down, for the people on the ground, there's a sense that there's a fundamental disconnect between the people who are fighting and dying on the ground and the people who are meeting in Geneva and trying to broker these deals. And I don't know how you try to essentially fill the abyss or bring back both sides. At the moment, the opposition in Geneva is not speaking for the opposition on the ground.
And even those there, this is a little bit from Salim al-Muslat, the spokesman for the so-called High Negotiations Committee, opposition groups, saying yesterday in Geneva, it's too early to see what comes of Putin's move. It all matter. What matters is what happens on the ground, as you say, in Syria. Here he is.
We have to be sure about the nature of this decision and what it means. If there is a decision to pull troops, then this is positive. We have to see that translated on the ground.
So Clarissa Ward with CNN, just back from Syria, there's a lot of interpretation here going on that perhaps Putin is by withdrawing so that now Assad doesn't have all that Soviet air cover, is pressuring him to maybe even step back, which is the ultimate demand of, at least for now, of opposition groups there. Do you see that dynamic emerging here?
Well, I think there's definitely been a lot of speculation as to that point. We heard the Syrian delegation over the weekend saying that Bashar al-Assad leaving is a red line, holding presidential elections is a red line. Pretty strong rhetoric that is significantly divergent from the rhetoric that we had heard coming from the Kremlin. So it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility that President Putin felt that perhaps the Syrian regime were becoming a bit too big for their britches. And that they weren't, entering into these negotiations in Geneva with good faith, that in fact they were trying to make a grab almost for more power. So that is possible. It's also possible that President Putin is aware of the fact that he has a failing economy on the back of extremely low oil prices and sanctions. It's possible that he's trying to avoid the sort of mission creep that saw the Soviet military bogged down in Afghanistan for years. It's even possible that he simply saw, that the civilian count was becoming unsustainable, that Russia was going to be ultimately potentially tried for war crimes. It's very difficult. I've lived in Russia twice, and I've learned my lesson in terms of trying to, read the tea leaves as to the opaque thinking that goes on in President Putin's mind and in the minds of the Kremlin. But certainly, I do feel, talking to people on the ground, that there is, dare I use the cliche, some cautious optimism that this does potentially signify some kind of a turning point.
And we just have half a minute, Clarissa, about a victory, maybe, for John Kerry here? He's been pushing on negotiations and peace talks for so long. Is this a signal of cooperation from Putin on that front?
Potentially, it is a signal of cooperation, or certainly it's at least intended to look like a signal of cooperation or a gesture of good faith. But I would say it's way too early to talk about victory yet, because even if you do get both sides to the negotiating table, even if you do have some kind of an improvement in the situation for the civilians living under that relentless bombardment, with Russia withdrawing its military, you still have an enormous way to go before we talk about what actually needs to be done to repair Syria and to make that country whole again.
Clarissa Ward, senior international correspondent for CNN. She's just back from Syria, her series Undercover in Syria. Clarissa, always great to have you right here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russia's surprise announcement of a substantial exit from Syria, pulling the main part of its troops and planes out, Vladimir Putin says. Why they're going, what it means, where it leaves Syria, the region, the U.S. Back in September, speaking through an interpreter at the U.N. General Assembly, Russian President Vladimir Putin said his country was assisting the fight against terrorist groups in the Middle East with their then-surprise intervention.
Today we provide military and technical assistance both to Iraq and Syria and many other countries of the region who are fighting terrorist groups. We think it is an enormous mistake to refuse to cooperate with the Syrian government and its armed forces who are valiantly fighting terrorism face to face.
The Russian bombing was fierce. It began quickly here in October. The sound of Russian planes dropping bombs near the city of Homs and a Syrian civilian on the ground reacting to the bombing. By all reports, turning the tide in favor of President Bashar al-Assad. And then at a meeting at the Kremlin in Moscow yesterday, Putin suddenly saying Russia's involvement had basically hit its marks, its targets, its goals. With the assistance of the participation of Russian troops and military, Syrian troops and patriotic forces, he said there, able to radically change the situation fighting international terrorism, that's the way he always put it, and take the initiative in nearly all areas to create the conditions for the start of a peace process, as I said. Putin sort of declaring a kind of victory or a moment of accomplishment there yesterday. You can join us this hour. Has Putin caught you by surprise again, caught everybody by surprise? How do you see the chess move this time? Do you envy Russia getting in, getting out, as opposed to our long slogs? And do you see Moscow pressuring Assad to make a deal? I want to bring in two guests. First in the region, Noah Bonzi joins us. He is senior Syria analyst for the International Crisis Group and joining us today from Istanbul in neighboring Turkey. Noah Bonzi, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
And from Washington, Jeffrey Mankoff is here, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Jeffrey Mankoff, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Noah, first to you, how are you interpreting this? How are you hearing this interpreted in the region?
Well, I think you've put it well. It's caught us all off balance. And I think it's helpful to look at just how quickly this Russian lurch has occurred. We spoke a bit more than a month ago during the first gathering of Syrian opposition and regime sides for negotiations in Geneva.
Yeah.
And at the time, as we spoke, Russia escalated massively militarily in Aleppo, very extensive airstrikes. It seemed that they had no interest in a viable political process at that time. Now, just a bit more than a month later, as there's again a gathering of the two Syrian sides in Geneva, Putin has basically done just the opposite. He signaled a significant reduction of the Russian military footprint and a further Russian investment in the political process. So what are we to make of that rapid shift? Is Russia really now going to throw its weight behind the political process? Is this simply a tactical move, something that could be walked back from later? It's really just too early to tell.
Jeffrey Mankoff in Washington, how are you interpreting what has so suddenly emerged here? We've already got photos out of the Russians say their jet fighters headed home.
Yeah, I think it did catch even those of us who pay attention to Russian foreign policy on a pretty regular basis off guard as well. But that said, you know, the Russians have always, I think, been involved in this conflict with an eye to some kind of a political settlement. The Russians I've talked to both here and in Moscow have been pretty clear in thinking that, Assad was never going to completely reassert control over the country and that the goal of Russian intervention was to allow him to stay in power, to turn the tide militarily, and to allow him to negotiate from a position of strength. And I think now they're at a point in the aftermath of the gains that the Syrian government forces have made in the last couple of weeks, where there actually is some prospect of Assad being able to negotiate from a position of strength.
Do you think – I mean, I've got a lot of listeners here saying, look, the Russians just can't afford it, so they'll call it victory and get out. You know, they can't afford to stay. Is there merit to that, Jeffrey?
I think it may be one consideration, but honestly, the financial cost of this operation for Russia hasn't been all that severe. They've been spending somewhere between $2 and $3 million a day on carrying out these operations, which in the scheme of things, in the scheme of their overall military budget, is not a major burden. At the same time, of course, their economy is performing poorly. Oil prices are low, and they're trying to rein in spending across a number of fronts. So certainly not having this operation weighing down the budget as well is a net benefit for them.
And Noah, there in Istanbul, there's a lot of talk that this is intended by Moscow perhaps to pressure Bashar al-Assad to make a deal or even signal that he would at some point himself step down, step aside. Does that feel credible?
It's certainly one possibility. And it's important here to keep in mind some longer-term differences distinguishing the Syrian regime's goals on one hand and Russia's goals on the other. I was in Moscow a few weeks ago. You know, I heard the same thing in private that Russian officials have consistently said in public, which is that, you know, they want to prevent regime change in Syria, but they are not married to the person of Bashar Assad. And in recent regime statements, in particular a press conference given by the foreign minister a few days ago, the Syrian foreign minister, there were real signs of the regime taking Russian support for granted, making direct statements about the regime's capacity to retake the entire country militarily, and a red line around any concessions regarding President Assad's fate, statements by the Syrian foreign minister that were very much contradictory to the official Russian line. Now, with this announcement yesterday, Putin is at minimum sending a clear signal to Damascus that the regime cannot take for granted Russian support. Now, it's too early to see to determine whether Russia will indeed use the leverage it has to push the regime for real concessions. But by taking a step back, signaling to the regime that they can't depend necessarily on a blank check, while also maintaining the capacity to re-escalate if necessary, Russia is really maximizing its leverage with Damascus.
I mean, Noah, they've still got their naval base, which they've had it since the Cold War era, in Taras on the Mediterranean coast. They've got the new air base that they put up for this, Latakia. It looks like they could be back there and in action again in hours if Putin changed his mind once more.
Right, and we'll see just how much Russia does reduce its military footprint in the coming days. You know, by all accounts, they have started to do this, but I think you've characterized it correctly. This keeps their options open. They've effectively declared victory, so if they do indeed want to completely wind down or dramatically wind down military operations, including the very important airstrikes that Clarissa described earlier, they can do that. If, on the other hand, they view it in their interest at any point to re-escalate, to help the regime again reassert dominance in parts of Syria, that option is open. So, you know, good tactical play, if nothing else.
Jeffrey Mankoff, if Russia has made this snap announcement in part because they saw Assad becoming cocky on the basis of his resurgence with their air support and more, if they wanted to push him towards some kind of concession, what kind of concession? I mean, after all, he's their ally. They came apparently because he's their ally. They showed the world they would support an ally. What kind of concessions might they want from him at this point?
Well, I think it's important to draw a distinction between the person of Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime that he heads, because I think what Russia is interested in is having a government in place in Damascus that is basically secular, that's not dominated by Sunni extremist groups, that allows Russia to maintain its military facilities, and that is responsive to Russian geopolitical interests. And whether that government is headed by the person of Bashar al-Assad or is headed by somebody else, you know, I think Moscow is basically agnostic about. The relationship between Putin and Assad is not, by all accounts, particularly close. I don't think the Russians feel invested in Bashar to the same extent that they felt invested in his father, who was the Syrian leader for many years before. And I think they're looking at it in a very pragmatic way, that if at the end of the day Assad is a pawn who has to be sacrificed for the larger geopolitical interests that Russia is pursuing, then they're prepared to sacrifice him, but only at the end of the process rather than as something that they're going to concede preemptively.
How would you define that larger geopolitical interest that Moscow is pursuing in all this?
Well, I think the main thing, again, is to maintain their military foothold in Syria at a time when they're expanding their assets and their position all around the eastern Mediterranean. I think also, as they've done very successfully, inserted themselves into the larger geopolitical conversation in the Middle East. I mean, you can't discuss the future of the region now without having Moscow at the table. And in some ways, I think that was a big part of this intervention as well. You know, the concern about regime change, which they saw the U.S. Carrying out in Iraq and then in Libya without any concern for Russian interests and, as they would argue, for the interests of the people in the region, trying to put a stop to that and ensuring that Russia would have a voice in ensuring that the future of the region would be something that, you know, the U.S. could not decide unilaterally.
Lots of intersecting interests here, some in opposition and then maybe spillover effects intended or not. Jeffrey, please stand by in Washington. Noah Bonzi in Istanbul. Danielle is calling from Woodward, Iowa. Danielle, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I think Putin accomplished exactly what he intended, which was to destabilize Europe by unleashing a population bomb, harboring these poor individuals who are forced out of their countries, who will continue with their cultural patterns of having many, many children who will then grow up not to have jobs. Europe is probably looking at England. England was suffering from a similar situation. So if you destabilize Europe, your greatest philosophical threat, Putin's accomplished exactly what he wanted to do here.
Daniel, that is so interesting. Noah, may I bring that to you in Istanbul? I mean, that movement of refugees did begin before the Russian bombing, but the Russian bombing just saw it swell into an enormous wave. Are you prepared to see Putin acting in that sort of three-dimensional chess game way here, that he would have seen. Look, our bombing drives people out of Syria. That destabilizes Europe. That works for us. Do you hand that to him, Noah? Do you see that?
It's certainly possible, and it's a concern that I share, and particularly when you look at where Russia helped the regime and its militia allies escalate in northern Syria, particularly in northwestern Syria. It was indeed contributing towards the movement of thousands, tens of thousands of civilians toward the Turkish border. That said, escalating in that way, even if it hurts Europe, is not without risk to Russia. And I think one concern that Russia has had to balance here is that, you know, it has a substantial Muslim population of its own, primarily Sunni Muslims. In intervening on behalf of a very brutal regime, dominated by an Alawite minority, backed by Iran and Shiite militias, in a regional environment that has become very polarized along sectarian lines, Russia runs the risk in its intervention in Syria of really being seen to take sides in what is increasingly perceived as a sectarian war. And
I mean, they hardly seemed afraid of that, Noah. That didn't seem to be much of a speed bump, did it?
So it certainly wasn't a sufficient speed bump to deter them from intervening. I absolutely agree. But it is a concern that has come up repeatedly in public and private. It's raised by Russian officials. Again, not something that would have been more important to them than the primary priorities that have been identified in discussion, including establishing Russia's role on a major global stage and preventing another example of Western-backed regime change. But it is an incentive, this concern, the concern of being seen to have chosen sectarian sides in a radicalizing transnational conflict, is enough of a concern that it may have provided some incentive for Russia to seek to withdraw at least reduce its footprint while still ahead and in a position to proclaim victory. So I'm not arguing really against the hypothesis raised by the caller, but merely pointing out that there are some competing interests here and concerns that Russia is weighing.
Jeffrey Mankoff, can you see Putin sitting, looking at the map in the Kremlin and, you know, saying, hey, this is awesome, I stabilize Assad, I show that we're a player, and I destabilize Europe?
I know a number of European officials have raised the concern that Russia is seeking to weaponize or instrumentalize the refugee flows. And certainly I don't exclude that that was a deliberate tactic that the Russian government was undertaking, not only vis-a-vis European countries, but also, of course, vis-a-vis Turkey, where the relationship has really gone south in the last couple of months. That said, you know, I think Noah is right that there is a danger of a sectarian backlash. And so
inside even, Russia, even.
Well, inside Russia, but against Russian interests, whether inside the country or out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was the bombing of the Russian airliner in Egypt shortly after the announcement of the intervention. And I do think the Russians understand the danger of getting bogged down in an increasingly sectarian conflict.
One more call right here. If I may, forgive me. Yeah. Gary in Middlesbrough, Kentucky. Gary, you're on.
Hi, Tom. We have to consider a large segment of the Syrian population, a portion, to me, that seems to be put to the sidelines or completely forgotten, and that's the Christians of Syria. And Christian militias have been fighting alongside the Syrian Arab army. Several years ago, Putin said that one of the hallmarks of Russian foreign policy would be to protect persecuted Christians worldwide. And this is right during the first Arab Springs in both Egypt and Syria. And we have to consider, too, the Russian relationship with the Syrian peoples goes back before the days of the USSR. The relationship goes back centuries before, especially with Russian pilgrims having traveled to the Holy Land via Syria and the Christian Syria.
But you're welcoming the intervention along these lines, Gary.
Yes, because otherwise the persecution of Christians would triple fold.
Persecution by ISIS?
ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and to me, the boogeyman is not the boogeyman of the North Russia. The boogeyman are what I call the Sunni triad, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. They are the financiers of the various Islamic factions that some people just, you know, they just call them the Syrian rebels, but we have to look at them as to what they really are. They are Islamists.
It's a complicated map. Russian jet fighters, we're told, flying north across it as we speak, flying home. Gary, thank you for your call. We'll look at that. Noah Bonzi with the International Crisis Group. Thank you for being with us from Istanbul in Turkey for a minute today, Noah. Wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about Russia's surprise announcement of a substantial exit from Syria, pulling the main part of its troops and planes out, Vladimir Putin says. Of course, still a Navy base there, a port, still an air base that they put up for this intervention. We're looking at why Russia's pulling out, what it's pulling out, what it means, where it leaves Syria, the region, the U.S. perhaps here. You can join us. Does Putin look smart here? Get in, turn the tide to your ally, get out. With their airbase in Syria, their seaport, their jets a few hours away, is Russia still calling the shots? What about the Syrian people? What's left of the country, the future? What happens here? Jeffrey Mankoff is with us from the Russia and Eurasian Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Andrew Tabler joins us in just a moment from the Washington Institute for Near East Studies. Here's a sound of the UN Security Council welcoming Russia's announcement yesterday. The Security Council President Angola's Ismael Abro Gaspar Martins.
We have also took note, very good note, of the decision by the Russians to withdraw part of their forces or start withdrawing part of their forces. That's what we'd like to see. When we see forces withdrawing, it means war is being taken a different step. So that's good.
Good. Good note. But there were a lot of rough notes here. This is a little bit of Al Jazeera, people in power back in February. Here's a Syrian man describing Russia's airstrike of a market where he stood, said this was not about going after terrorists, which is what Vladimir Putin said, of course, when Russia went in. Standing in the market there, a Russian airplane hit this place with three rockets. One landed here and 13 or 14 people killed. Killed a guy selling vegetables over there. On the other side, a trader, his three sons were killed. A father and three sons. Who are they calling terrorists? This is a market, he says right there. And yesterday, a press conference at the White House, Press Secretary Josh Earnest saying the presence of Russian troops in Syria had been an obstacle to peace talks.
Russia's continued military intervention to prop up the Assad regime made the efforts to reach a political transition or to make a political transition even more difficult.
Jeffrey Mankoff, stand by, please, in Washington. Andrew Tabler joins us as well, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Andrew Tabler, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
We've heard you talk a little about this, but your sort of first-line interpretation of why Vladimir Putin is heading those jets home?
I think that, obviously, President Putin, intervened in Syria, flexed some muscle, kept the Assad regime from a further radical contraction, but I think was sobered up by the incredibly rigid position of the regime going into peace talks, which started yesterday with the regime, not with the opposition. And today, the day after that meeting, the fifth anniversary of the Syrian uprising, Putin dramatically decides to take his jets home and at least partially hangs Assad out to dry in terms of the negotiations. But at the same time, doesn't cut complete ties with him. So a very shrewd move at a very important time.
What would Vladimir Putin want from these negotiations ultimately, and what part of that might Assad be unwilling to give?
I think that the Russians want President Assad to talk about a viable government, a transition of sorts in Syria, which would preserve part of the regime, but not make him necessarily the core of it or the head of it. That would be more accepting and more inclusive of members of the moderate Syrian opposition. And of course, it's a bit of a project because the Assad regime, as currently constructed, is one of the most centralized and tyrannical that we face across the Middle East, which is really saying something. So I think that the Russians would like Assad to negotiate, to talk about presidential elections, to talk about some kind of new government. But his statements and that of his foreign minister, Walid Mualim, in recent days indicated they were not up for that, and Putin was not up for staying and watching all that.
Jeffrey Mankoff, let's say that Putin's withdrawal gets to the regime and they say, okay, we'll talk. I mean, can you picture a deal, a post-Civil War equilibrium that all the parties here could accept? It seems almost unimaginable, but is it out there, Jeffrey?
Well, it depends which parties we're including here. I mean, one of the challenges is there are so many factions in Syria, and some of them, like ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, are basically considered beyond the pale by all of the other participants and combatants. And so even if you have some kind of a political deal between Assad and the basically moderate opposition, which Russia has spent a lot of time arguing doesn't exist, that doesn't deal with the fact that a substantial part of the country remains under the control of the radical opposition. And there are still real questions about whether the Syrian government forces, with or without Russian air support, are going to be able to take back those parts of the country. So this, I would argue, is at best it's a positive step that could lead to some kind of a political deal, but it's not ultimately going to resolve all of the underlying issues that led to the conflict in Syria.
Andrew Tabler, can you see somehow emerging from negotiations some sort of equilibrium that would be established that even might serve, create a united front against ISIS or a footing of circumstances that would provide a footing against ISIS? Is that even out there?
I think it's a long shot at this point. I would agree. The problem is that it's not just the fragmentation of groups. It's the Assad regime has had to resort to such brutality that a settlement is that much harder. And it's not just the use of most Americans are familiar with the what is now known as the non-strike incident of 2013. The red line incident. But remember, besides Assad on multiple occasions using chemical weapons against his own people.
Yes.
But also the launch, he's also used, and I think now is maybe the second largest user of surface missiles on his own people as well. You know, when you're firing Scud missiles on your own people for 5 years and trying to shoot them into submission, and you only control about a quarter to a third of Syrian territory, and you go into a negotiating position with the Russians at your back thinking that you're going to retake the entire country. I think that I think Putin in the recent days has realized that Assad was deluding himself and decided to hang out at least partially to dry, not to withdraw his support, not to
just let him feel the chill wind, a touch of the relic here.
Partially, but not giving up on him. The Russians are not giving up on him. It's a much narrower move, I think, and we'll have to watch and see how it plays out.
Does this affirm, Andrew Tabler, the value of John Kerry's long, grueling diplomacy on the Syria front, which often, at least from outside, looked like, what are you doing? It's fruitless, but maybe not. Does this affirm the value of that?
No, I don't think so. I think that this was something that was decided by the Kremlin. Now, it doesn't mean that it didn't empower the MFA to have these kind of negotiations, but I think that this would have went on regardless of who was Secretary of State. I think it was useful, but I think this is one of those times that, pulling a rabbit out of your hat is harder here than it was on the Iranian negotiations, just because there are a lot more players involved. So we'll have to wait and see how this goes. His negotiations, Kerry's negotiations with Lavrov, might
Russian foreign minister
a little
mm-hmm.
bit.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, but we're not going to. I don't think we're going to see an easy resolution as we saw in the Iranian nuclear deal.
Bashir is calling from Boston. Hi, Bashir. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment here is really what we are talking about is like a chess game and who's winning, who's losing, and we under describing the suffering of the Syrian people, which is 12 million out of their home, whether out the country or out of within the country, and about 500,000 dead. Which has to always been emphasized. Also, we have not talked about if, and that's my question here, if the world would face a Jewish leader who would kill 500,000 of his own people, how would the world stand?
I mean, I take your point. There's enormous suffering here. You may have missed it. We have been looking at the markets bombed, the terrible refugee flows, the displacement, and where so much of this fell. But, Jeffrey, it is never wrong to turn again and look at the human toll of what has been unfolding here. Net-net, has the Russian intervention ameliorated or deepened that suffering?
It's in the short term, it's certainly deepened it, just as we've heard all the descriptions of the various civilian targets that have been struck by the Russians. And I think the Russians have never displayed a particular concern for civilian casualties, whether in Syria, in Chechnya, in Afghanistan, and in any of the places that their military has intervened. I don't think that's one of their major considerations. But, you know, it's hard to have a sense of what would have happened over the longer term had this intervention not taken place. You know, if the Syrian civil war were to drag on for another several years, you know, maybe the number of people who would have been killed or displaced would have been equally large, which is not to justify the Russians' targeting of civilians or the suffering that their intervention has caused. It's just, I think, to try and point out that there's a lot of moral ambiguity around this.
And we should sustain a strong, strong note of skepticism throughout this. I mean, the British foreign minister saying today, you know, Putin's made pledges in the past to pull troops out of Ukraine. Those turned out to just be a routine rotation of forces. And here's an AFP news report just breaking that Russian airstrikes have hit Palmyra as Syrian troops, government troops, advance there. Who knows? Bombing on the way home or just still bombing? Lots of response online here and people looking at the Russian example, Americans, I'm suspecting, and saying, you know, there was a prediction of quagmire. I think President Obama made that for Moscow. 29er says, what happened to the quagmire? Putin is demonstrating that a military can pack its suitcase and leave, which is exactly what Bush should have done after he discovered there was no WMD in Iraq. And Saeed says, you mean it's possible to enter a conflict in the Middle East and not stay there indefinitely and have thousands of troops and become a constant part of the region's problems? Scott, in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on, Scott. Thanks for calling.
I think both those questions are really interesting, those comments, because I take the opposite view in that I think, you know, this is going to serve as an example of what happens if we just jump out of a conflict very quickly, and we'll be able to watch the Russian experience over the next 6 months, 5 years, what have you. And contrast it against, I think, what is our developing understanding that once you, you know, bomb out in a country and incite regime change, we really buy a part of their future and need to be in it for the long haul. And certainly in an election cycle as we are now, I think, you know, it's food for thought for us to be taking into consideration as we select the future direction we want to take our country with a potential leader who and how they would interact in these situations.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I appreciate your call, Scott. I mean, Andrew, people may look at this and it can look so clean, like in 6 months, bam, bam, tons of suffering on the bottom of that and lots of hospitals and markets and people died and all the rest. But Russia headed home and it looks clean. On the other hand, I mean, they've still got their naval base there. They've got an air base there. When Americans think about intervention, do we learn anything from this Putin example, Andrew?
Well, it certainly is the counterargument to President Obama's slippery slope theory, which he put forward in an interview with in The Atlantic this last week.
Like even in Libya, where we were there for just a couple of months, and it's a mess still.
Well, nobody guarantees that there's going to be a peaceful resolution to these things.
Absolutely right.
Can you intervene and protect your interests and protect the safety of Americans and keep things from morphing out of control in a very narrow, controlled way? President Putin proved that you can do that. Now, how this is all going to end, we don't know. But remember, in the case of Syria, we didn't break Syria. Iraq, we broke it. Mm-hmm. We invaded the country, knocked out the government, and then messed up the administration of the country. Everybody knows that. It's not a secret. In Syria, we did the polar opposite, much because the president wanted to. And we still ended up with this horrible situation of not only biggest humanitarian disaster since the Second World War, but the largest generator of extremism and refugee flows that could very well destabilize Europe in terms of bringing far-right parties to power that are closer to Russia than they are to the United States. And that is a multi-tiered loss for American interests as a result of the Syria conflict.
In the region, Andrew, as we sit here today, told that Russian planes are headed home, how do you look at the ripple on of this? Is Assad's future dimmed? Is ISIS in better or worse situation with Russia headed out?
Well, certainly by removing air assets from Syria, it would seem to make to extend ISIS's lease on life and that of the al-Qaeda elements nearby. But it also could induce President Assad and the regime particularly to make real changes. I wouldn't hold your breath, though. This is just the latest twist in a very long story. And I'm afraid we're going to have to, and the Syrian people are going to have to continue suffering until someone can come up with an idea of how to not only settle this conflict down, but ultimately how to solve it. And that is the hard work for the next American president and his partners around the world.
And Jeffrey,
or her.
Yes, or her. Just briefly, Jeffrey, at home, you're our Russia guy. How does Putin look pulling out? Will Russians applaud this six-month intervention or not?
I mean, until or unless there's a major terrorist attack against Russia, I think probably they will. You know, this looks like an example of a successful intervention. We went in, we did what we said we came to do, and we got out, and we had very few casualties in the process.
Of course, this whole thing is not over, and we'll see where it heads. Jeffrey Mankoff at the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Andrew Tabler, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Andrew, great to have you with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
In this hour tomorrow, we will be all over the primary results from the big, big voting going on right now in five states. Join us for that. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.